What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Hi, it's Dr. Will Cole. This podcast is the manifesto for a new breed of health seekers. This is the art of being well. What's up, and welcome to The Art of Being Well. I am a leading functional medicine expert. I get to consult people around the world via webcam, and I'm a New York Times bestselling author. I wrote Intuitive Fasting, which is my newest book, and The Inflammation Spectrum, and Ketotarian. If you want to learn more about my clinical work, the telehealth center, the books, there's lots of free healthy stuff for you there as well. You can check it all out at drwillcole.com. That's drwillcole.com. And my friends, listeners of The Art of Being Well, I am giving away free signed books. You can pick whichever one you want out of the three so far. All you have to do is head on over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review The Art of Being Well. And then you can message me on Instagram at Dr. Will Cole and just say, hey, I left a review. And then my team and I will go through the messages. And every month, no matter when you're listening to this episode, we will be randomly picking winners and sending a book of your choice signed to whoever you want, you, yourself, anyone you want. And you can have the book. So to enter to win, head on over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review. It really helps to get the message out there, and we can help more people the more people listen to the podcast. All right, let's get to today's guest. His name is Vladimir Vukacevic. He is an entrepreneur and expert in the world of consumer products. He has taught Fortune 500 companies how to build and leverage new businesses, has combined culture and management theory through his writing, and believes that innovation provides a new path to personal and global empowerment. Vlad is the CEO and co-founder of Better and Better, a company that develops and sells personal care products that are fundamentally better for our health and better for our environment. All right, let's get to it. This is Vladimir Vukacevic's Art of Being Well. Vlad, my friend, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor. I'm a big fan.
Oh, man. I love what you're doing. I'm a big fan. So you have an inspirational story. People are going to learn so much from you today. But I want to start where you came from and what you went through.
Sure.
Let's go back to, you're from Yugoslavia originally, right?
That's right. Yeah. So I was born in Yugoslavia.
By the way, real fast. So my great-grandma is Serbian. So I like to feel like a kinship with the Serbian people.
Really?
Yeah, Serbian Orthodox Church, all of that. So
yeah.
By no means have the cred that you have. So I'll let you talk.
Yeah. I'm not sure Will Cole is a Serbian.
No,
but it doesn't scream Serbian.
No, it's not. But Vukic is.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah. I'm a first generation immigrant. So hence the Vladimir. And I was born in Yugoslavia, in Belgrade, which is now Serbia. And its own little country. And, you know, I was born early 80s, growing up there. And then in 1990, when I was about 5 years old, I started having pain in my right leg. It went on for a few months. The doctors first thought it was like growing pains. You know, you're a kid, kids have that. But once they did an X-ray, they realized that it was a cancerous tumor. I was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma. It's a bone cancer. in my right thigh bone as a five-year-old. And in Serbia back then, or Yugoslavia back then, the medical institutions weren't doing too great. And so my parents made the brave decision to come to the U.S. for treatment. So I came to Sloan Kettering here in New York for treatment when I was 5 years old. And, you know, for better or for worse, that treatment lasted about almost a decade, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So it was pretty arduous, chemotherapy, radiation, a bunch of surgeries, you know, came out of it clean and healthy. It set my life up for a very interesting course, because as a young kid, I knew and understood things about life, mortality, health, wellness, physical therapy, nutrition, that I think the average kid and then teenager and adolescent doesn't usually go through.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I can only imagine the deep learning and experience and, you know, trauma in many ways to have to grow up so fast and go through those things. Do you ever go back and think about that? Or how do you feel like that shaped how you see the world today?
It's one of the reasons I go to therapy on a regular basis.
Certainly.
And I think that it's a trauma that lives with me, in me, forever. It's just a matter of, like, how do I utilize that? How do I use that as a catalyst for positive things? I'm lucky that I had and have supportive parents that have always been kind of open to different ideas. So my dad has been practicing transcendental meditation for 30 plus years. He's a TM teacher. So I learned about kind of inner calming, inner peace, TM, which I've been practicing since I was a little kid. He also knows about Ayurvedic treatments and other additional kind of holistic treatments, which in 1990, when I was diagnosed and we came here, that was kind of like crazy, right? It was like the doctors wouldn't even listen to you. Whereas if you go to Sloan Kettering now, it's all about the full holistic set of treatments. And so just being introduced to that as a kid kind of like opens up your world very early on, that there isn't just, you know, there's traditional Western medicine, but there are other forms of medicine, treatment, cures, benefits. So that was one big thing. And then the other is just the power of habits. So when you're in a tough spot, little daily activities become really, really important. Getting out of bed after a surgery. Like, they want you out of bed right away.
Yeah.
They want you walking right away. I had chemotherapy, so they want you kind of eating right, and they want the right nutrition and the right supplements. So these daily habits were embedded within my life from the get-go. And so it kind of shaped and continues to shape how I think about the world and how I build ideas and products.
Yeah. Well, I love hearing about TM and its role that it's played in unraveling the trauma and transmuting it. What would you say TM was the most effective trauma tool for you, or what's another one?
Yeah. So I think TM is definitely the one that's like the most constant. So daily practice, I think that helps a lot. I think in addition to that, you know, traditional psychotherapy, I use psychotherapy and psychoanalytic psychotherapy kind of as a release valve, because we'll talk about my entrepreneurial experiences, but as an entrepreneur, there are a lot of daily stresses. So it's like that old trauma plus the daily stresses wrapped up. So being able to release that, I think, is really, really key. I've started doing acupuncture over the last 2 or 3 years. For whatever reason, I hadn't done it up to kind of later now in my life. And when I started doing it, I was like, oh, interesting. This is a whole different world of experience and release as well.
Yeah.
It's very, most of the things I did were very mind-centric. Whereas when you start to get into acupuncture, it's all about the body and the energy and the flows of those things. So it was things that I hadn't experienced before. So I think those three things, it's meditation, therapy, and acupuncture that kind of keep me relatively stable. Yeah.
Supporters of your parasympathetic, without a doubt.
Yeah.
All of them.
Absolutely.
So at what point in your journey did you discover low vitamin D and its importance to human health and maybe the connection to your immune health specifically?
Sure. So when I was in college, I started kind of losing some of my edge that I had when I was kind of teenager, late teenager. You know, I go to regular checkups at Sloan Kettering. I go to regular blood tests and all that, but they hadn't been doing vitamin D tests up to that point. And those, like the early 2000s, they started doing regular vitamin D tests, and they started seeing kind of, you could see it, a decline, because you could see the trends. So between the age of like 16 and 22, I started seeing a decline. Mm. And it was almost perfectly matched with the lower kind of mood, lower energy that I had at that point. And I started getting sick a little bit more often. You start to kind of, it starts to add up the different symptoms. And so I started taking vitamin D supplements as a in pill form in college. And so I've been doing it for 15 plus 20, almost 20 years now in terms of vitamin D supplements, and really started to see improvement after a few months of supplement form. But the tricky part with pills, it has different problems with it. One is just remembering. So after college, I started working entrepreneurship, and like taking another pill, another thing on a daily basis became really tough for me. So I would go missing for days, sometimes weeks at a time. Yeah. And that's not great. And then in addition to that, there are no low dose pills. Most of the pills are 100 plus daily value, sometimes 500, 1,000. And so it's a jarring experience for my system. And so it would affect my, like I would have gastrointestinal issues and just in general would have, I wouldn't feel great about right after taking it. And it would be fine after a while, but in that immediate aftermath, I had a tough time with the pills. So remembering them plus the magnitude of them kind of was challenging, but overall it helped me a lot to get vitamin D up because it started to help with mood, immunity, and just overall just kind of vigor and strength.
Got it. So, yeah. I mean, I'm looking at labs all day long for patients and I see how ubiquitous vitamin D deficiency is. So, but you know a lot about this as well. Can you share for the people how common vitamin D deficiency is? And then why should people care? They know, they hear about it, but it's abstract to the average listener or person out there in the world. Why should we care about vitamin D status?
The stats kind of vary a little bit, but you know, at this point, I think they're saying well over 50%. Most people in the United States are vitamin D deficient to some extent. A lot of that has to do with how we get vitamin D and how we used to get vitamin D. The biggest way we used to get vitamin D is we would go outside in the fields and work and play and do things. And sunlight is the predominant delivery mechanism for vitamin D. And that has changed for various reasons over the last 100 years plus. One is we're less outdoors. And when we are outdoors, we are more covered both in terms of clothing, but also in terms of sunscreen and other protective mechanisms. So generally, vitamin D from sunlight has gone down dramatically. Mm-hmm. And then also from food too. Like there aren't that many foods that can deliver meaningful amounts of vitamin D. And a lot of those foods, you know, are problematic depending on where you stand, whether it's meats, eggs, dairy, all those foods can give you vitamin D in a nice amount. But, you know, now trends are going against that. So that's why generally, so many people are vitamin D deficient, and it's growing because we're indoors and we're eating differently. What does that do? Vitamin D broadly is kind of linked to bone and muscle health, just to start. So muscle health and bone health in particular degrade after vitamin D deficiency starts to show up. So everything from being active to bone fractures are often further linked to vitamin D and calcium deficiencies because those two are very interlinked. Then in addition to that, to the like the baseline, there are now connecting vitamin D to mood and emotional wellness, being happy. Like you would think, you know, that's not necessarily something extrinsic, but when you start to look at it, it does affect. And so seasonal affective disorder in many ways is linked to vitamin D because it's during the winter, you're getting even less sunlight. Right. So there's less vitamin D. So mood and kind of emotional wellness, I think, is the second big bucket. And then the third bucket that's particularly, I think, relevant for today is immunity and the ability to fight off various diseases, viruses, bacteria, et cetera. Vitamin D, vitamin C, some of those kind of additional vitamins are very relevant for that. And I don't want to get into the whole COVID discussion, but vitamin D has been linked to worse COVID outcomes, worse symptoms. And so the idea of deficiency in vitamin D is also linked to not being able to fight off various diseases, in particular COVID and other diseases as well. So the idea of immunity, I think, emotional wellness plus physical wellness all are linked to vitamin D. So in summary, it's a very, very important vitamin.
Without a doubt. I mean, it's one of the only vitamins. It acts as almost a hormone, right? It's almost a pro-hormone. Every cell of your body has a vitamin D receptor site. So it's very different than other vitamins in many ways. And it's so, like you said, it's the sunshine vitamin. It's intimately connected to the human species and how we evolved over time. So,
and in the past, you know, they've done some analyses, like we were getting a ton of vitamin D, right? And we evolved with a ton of vitamin D just because of the nature of how human life was, hunting, gathering, and then farming and scavenging, like all those activities.
Yeah.
Gave us a lot of D.
Right. And again, this concept that I'm always talking about on the podcast is this mismatch between genetics and epigenetics. Our genetics haven't changed in these 10,000 plus years, but the way we live life. So a lot of what we're talking about on the podcast is decreasing that chasm between our DNA, which isn't changed, and the world around us. And you have, in a very innovative way, did a very smart thing to help us decrease that mismatch between genetics and epigenetics with getting something where you mentioned it's people are inconsistent with supplements many times. Mm-hmm. So tell people how you are helping us get our vitamin D levels and B vitamins where they should be.
After college, I became an entrepreneur. I started one company, then it was successful helping other entrepreneurs raise money. Then I started a second company helping artists reach the world. So I'm an active person. I fill my life with a lot of things, and just taking pills on a daily basis is not one of those things that I think about. And I had a really tough time, especially when traveling, which I did a fair amount of and do now again. I started really going deep dive. I did a deep dive into the concept of habits and habit matching and habit pairing, because I was like, if I'm going to get my vitamin D, it has to be integrated with my life in a more seamless way. Mm-hmm. And so I started reading all the books and doing all the research around habits and habit matching. It's much easier to create another habit if it's matched to an existing habit. It's much easier to tag along activities in your daily life. So I started keeping a journal and a diary of things that I do on a daily basis. And I kept this diary for like a year. Then I put it all into an Excel spreadsheet and I analyzed it. And the one recurring thing that happened no matter what is I brush my teeth two times a day, in the morning and the evening. Sometimes after lunch, if I'm at home or if I have time, but at least two times a day. And so it's like, okay, that's interesting. Of all the things I do that could be evolved or augmented, brushing my teeth is unique. And so that's when I got into the concept of sublingual and transbuccal absorption. So absorbing nutrients through your mouth. Sublingually is below the tongue, and buccally is through your gums, your cheeks, the other skin in the mouth. And the mouth skin is very, very absorbent. Doctors have been delivering pain medication, other forms of medication to patients for decades through sublingually. So they place a little tab or they place a couple of drops, something in your mouth, and it's absorbed and it goes straight into the bloodstream. So these two ideas started percolating in my mind of like, oh, I brush my teeth on a daily basis, and you could absorb a lot of nutrients and vitamins and other elements through your mouth. I was like, why can't you put vitamins and nutrients and supplements in general into toothpaste? The short answer is it's not easy, but you can do it. And that's what Better and Better is. It's the idea that we can make an existing habit even better by improving it and by adding another functional level to it. And in this case, it's toothpaste that gives you a microdose of vitamin D3 and vitamin B12 as well. We've combined those two in a single brush. So we have about 40% of vitamin D and about 50% of vitamin B12 per brush. So if you brush two or three times a day, that starts to add up into real quantities. So that's our first product. It's a 2-in-1 toothpaste that cleans your teeth in a natural, clean way. And then in addition to that, delivers a microdose of vitamins that, like we said, are very important.
Brilliant. And you're absolutely right. When you talk about habits and consistency, I see it with patient behavior like thousands and thousands of times over the past 12 plus years. And you are really making this something that people can stick with, because I would hope most people are brushing their teeth at least one time a day. And you're getting some of these doses, these really important nutrients in every dose, every time you brush your teeth. And you cite a lot of really exciting science in your literature. I was immersed in the research around oral and buccal like absorption rate, and even more so than gut. And when you think of people's gut health, and we don't always, I'm always telling patients, you aren't just what you eat and supplement with, you are what you absorb.
Yeah.
And if you have an unhealthy gut, which we work on with patients, but over time, that absorption improves. But at the beginning, they're not, they, and I see people take supplements that are consistent with it, and their numbers are not even where they should be because of the absorption barrier. So tell me about the different absorption rate of in your mouth versus taking a pill.
Yeah, so generally when you take a pill, you swallow it, either a pill or a gummy, they work pretty much the same way. The gummy starts to break down a little bit in your mouth because you're chewing it and then you swallow it, but a pill you just swallow, and then it goes into your gut, and then it passes through the full gastrointestinal system and then goes through the liver, and then it's finally absorbed into the bloodstream. So there are a lot of places for things to either get lost or fully evacuated in a way that is completely irrelevant to your blood and to your body. So, you know, they've done a bunch of studies around pills and gummy vitamins, and some of the absorption rates and the bioavailability, as it's called, is very low. Like, so in some cases, you know, 10% up to 20, 30, 40%, but the majority of what you swallow in a pill is generally just flushed out. So many of these pills have tremendous amounts of daily value. The manufacturers and the creators, you know, they understand that like your body pushes most of it out. So that's why they often pack it with a lot of quantity in order to, because they know you will only absorb a small amount of that quantity. And then in addition to the bioavailability problem, I think there's also the ingredient problem. So particularly with gummies, like there's gelatins, sugars, various food colorings in some cases that are just needless. Like we don't need to, we don't need this. For pills, it's more like cellulose and gelatins and in the capsules themselves. Things that you don't, like, they're not necessarily profoundly harmful, but if you don't need this extra thing, you don't, you shouldn't get it. Like we can avoid these the additional elements. Mm-hmm. So the idea of something that is absorbed in the mouth, like, solves a lot of those problems. One is it goes directly into the bloodstream. So the mouth has full of capillaries and blood vessels that are directly connected to the bloodstream, to the head and to the rest of the body. And so that's why often, you know, when pain medication is administered under the tongue, like the patients feel it much faster than they do when they take a pill, or even intravenously when they take pain medication. So the absorption rates are much faster. And in many cases, the absorption rates, the bioavailability is much higher, 50% in some cases, 60, 70 in other cases. So in general, we find that it's up to 4, 5, maybe even 10 times better in terms of bioavailability for those vitamins and nutrients. And there have been studies. We leverage a few dozen studies already, and we're conducting some of our own as well that show this. Like you take a capsule group and then you take a sublingual group. The sublingual group has either equal or better results with less material. And so if that's happening on a recurring basis with vitamin D, vitamin C, vitamin B12, a toothpaste like ours, like the Better and Better vitamin toothpaste, makes a lot of sense because you're going to get this vitamin and nutrient on a recurring over and over basis.
Love it.
Yeah.
All right, Vlad, you know, because you listen to the podcast, that at the end of every regular episode, I want to learn about your art of being well. And I'm going to just throw out some random questions to learn more about your wellness routine and favorites of all things. Are you up for this?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's jump into it. First question, what is the worst tasting healthy food that you still eat because it's good for you?
I got to be honest. Asparagus is my, what's the reverse it's my good, bad habit of food, because it's not just about the taste of it, but you know, the asparagus pea, it affects everything before and after eating asparagus. Yeah. So it's like, and my wife, she loves it. So between the two of us, we trade off, but we do, asparagus is the healthy one that I don't love.
Hey, I hear you. But yeah. It's good. It's high
it's good.
Sulfur compound, sulforaphane, great for methylation, detox, fiber, all the things. All right, next question, kind of similarly, what's the worst tasting healthy food that you won't eat because it's just that gross to you?
It's funny. Like I'm willing to eat most things and try most things. To be honest, I'm not a huge fan of like lettuce-based salads, like just pure green leaves. I like kale just because it has a little bit more flavor. Arugula I like because it has more flavor, but like traditional lettuce, I just dislike because it's like eating nothing. I want to eat something.
Yeah, I hear you.
And I know why people like it, but I don't.
I don't get into salads either. I mean, I don't. Yeah. We have recipes for patients. There's recipes in the book. Some people really, really love their salads. I agree. Like it's to me. And then you look at the other side of the spectrum where the Americans will just make the salads like basically a conduit for like all this junk food. It's like just turn this like, okay, whole food into this pile of crap.
That's right. And like by the time you make a salad taste acceptable, like it's not a salad anymore. It's a completely different type of food.
Yeah. It's a vehicle for other things.
That's right.
All right. Next question. What is your latest non-food, non-supplement wellness tool or biohack that you're really into?
I mean, we're talking about habits, but like I love micro habits and like 1 minute habits. Things where like at the start of COVID, you know, I did a little bit of exercise, but I didn't do a lot. And I was like, okay, can I do 5 pushups every night? And I was like, okay, 5 pushups. It literally takes 20 seconds, 10 seconds, whatever. And I was like, okay, let's do it. Every night, 5 pushups. And so this micro habit became 100 pushups in a year per day. And so it's this power of like just repetition, maybe even imperfect repetition, mm-hmm. but beneficial repetition that has become like life-changing for me. Like I feel different. You know, now I'm doing it with steps. I'm doing it with other exercises in the morning and the evening. So it starts to add up, but like just repetition is so, so key. And like, you know, better and better, like it's based on that concept. So
love it.
I better eat what I make. It's great.
Super smart and very actionable for everybody listening. Do you think we are better or worse off with social media?
Worse.
Okay.
It tipped into net negative over the last maybe 5 years, 6 years.
Yeah.
You know, my first company was a platform that helped people raise money online. It was a crowdfunding platform called Rocket Hub, kind of similar to Kickstarter, Indiegogo, some of these other crowdfunding platforms. And that was like social media for good, right? People raising money to make music or to make a new product. And I think there's still a lot of that happening. But I think between the addictive nature of it, mm-hmm. which I think is definitely present, the endorphin hits, the it's just manufactured for bringing you back into the world. So I think the addictive nature plus the like the social nature of it, like going to a dinner and seeing multiple people on their phone, they're not usually like reading a book on their phone. They're probably checking social media or something related to that.
Yeah.
So I think it's both addictive on an individual level and it's also starting to hurt interpersonal relationships. So I think it's tipped slightly into negative territory.
Yeah.
So
very astute. I hear you. And I tend to agree. Amazing good comes from it, right? Connecting right now. We're going to share this on social media. There are pockets of good, but I agree. Like the net negative is the larger picture of it. I mean, would it be so bad to just take us back to the 1990s? I mean, we had the internet then. It just was a lot more contained and less pervasive.
Oh. I was reading about recently, like someone suggested, I don't know if you remember the AOL Instant Messenger.
Oh yeah.
They had an away message.
Oh yeah.
Like just if we had away messages again on whatever, Twitter, WhatsApp, all the messaging apps that we, even Facebook, like I am away. I think like psychologically that would be so valuable because then like, okay, I'm away doing something.
Yeah.
You're justified in not being in that element. So I think there will be tools that will correct social media because, you know, entrepreneurially, there's money to be made in helping people feel better.
Right.
And I think people are starting to feel bad from social media. So if we can help generally the world feel better, I think there will be tools that will correct what's happening now.
Yeah,
man, I think you're absolutely right. And it is, we always have to be on, like a world is conditioned to be sucking you back in to always be on. And you're right. I think there's going to be the blowback of what's going on right now. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I hope that we find a better, healthier balance with these things.
I think ironically, it'll probably be technology helping us to be away from technology.
Yeah, you're right. Like you said, the entrepreneurial spirit of our country and the world really, hopefully we'll be innovative in that. All right, next question. If you were able to live to the age of 100 and keep mm-hmm. either the mind or the body of a 30-year-old for the last 70 years of your life, which would you want, the mind or body of a 30-year-old?
Absolutely the mind. And also, when I was a kid, I grew up, between the age of 5 and 10, I was mainly in bed. I created my own worlds in my mind. I experienced all kinds of things. And it was the early 90s, so we had TV. You said the internet was starting to develop, but it was still mainly kind of in your mind, toys, mm-hmm. Ideas, games. Yeah. So I think the mind makes our world. Mm-hmm. And if you start losing that, it's tough. I think the body, will be augmented very soon between, the stuff that Elon Musk is doing with Neuralink and some of the exoskeleton stuff. So helping people with paralysis be able to move. I think we're getting to a point where in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, the mind and body connection, will be different than it is today. So if I can keep my mind for the foreseeable future, just as long, let's make it to the singularity level, then I'll be okay.
Love it. Next question. What's one thing that somebody can do that maybe struggling with poor sleep or want to optimize your sleep? What's one way to get a great night's sleep?
I mean, getting back to what we were talking about before, my wife and I, we have a no technology in the bedroom rule. Literally nothing, no TV, no cell phone. Even my alarm clock is not it's just a manual, manual clock. Yeah. I think there have to be safe zones for stimulus or anti-stimulus and not to be overstimulated all the time. Yeah. So I think getting into the bedroom and reading a little bit or not, being stimulated in the way that social media and other forms of media do now, even TV, I think it does the same thing now, particularly with news and all that. Right. So just a technology-free bedroom has helped a lot for me.
Love that. Yeah, that's very smart. What's one way to increase?
It's hard.
It's difficult, right? Yeah. I'm right there with you. We don't have phones. Yeah. I don't have my phone near bed, but I have a TV. And you're right. It's difficult. It creates bad habits. Mm-hmm. It really does. I could tell you my favorite Netflix shows right now, but I won't. Right. What's one way to increase your energy levels with fatigue or lethargy or something like that?
Sure. It's we talked about sunlight. I think profoundly different. Even 10 minutes a day, arms, face, maybe legs as well. Anything. A little bit of sunlight goes, I think, a long way for me, both in terms of obviously vitamin D and what we were talking about, but also just knowing where I am. I think a lot of my tiredness and lethargy comes from not knowing what time it is, not having that. You were talking about our genetics versus the world we live in or the life we live. And I think one of those elements is the sun used to be a guide when you wake up, when you go to sleep, when you eat, when you drink, when you procreate, whatever, the sun helped us with that. And I think since we've lost that to a great degree, it affects everything.
Circadian rhythm.
I think, circadian rhythms. I use sunlight a lot also when I'm traveling, particularly between time zones. It's a big, big, big.
To reset that internal clock.
Strategy, sure. Yeah. So sunlight, I think, is a big one. And, little bits of micro activity, just walking around. Not being, these are little, pretty relatively well-known things, but they really do work. And I think, if you can just even tie it, for instance, I'm drinking water now, but often I put my cup, away. So when I'm drinking, I need to get up and drink a cup of water. So, there's these little hacks.
Love that.
That force activity.
Yeah.
That really kind of adds up because we're doing it every day, every week, every month, every year. So why not make it a little bit better, a little bit more active?
True. These are some really good tips, man. Next question. Do you know what Myers-Briggs you are or Enneagram type that you are?
Yeah, I'm an ENTJ. So I think I definitely veer towards extrovert, and it's a, you know, it's a common entrepreneurial kind of active kind of trait or collection of traits. Mm-hmm. I took the test about 15 years ago. So maybe I've, you know, people do evolve and they do change. You know, as I've gotten a little bit older, I've definitely gotten a little bit more internal versus being, you know, fully external, but that also is part of being in a, you know, a marriage and a committed relationship and all that. But yeah, ENTJ, which can be kind of manic a little bit sometimes. It could be a high and low, especially if I'm like, if I'm alone for a day or two, I tend to get depressed. So having external activity and interaction is really useful.
Do you know what type of Enneagram you are? Enneagram?
I don't.
You need to find out. Vlad,
okay.
For next time, we'll find out.
Hopefully you'll have me back.
Of course.
Yeah. Enneagram. Okay.
What's your favorite, not necessarily a health food, but a better for you snack food alternative that you love?
Greek yogurt. Greek yogurt has done a lot for me because it has protein. It has a little bit of fat, but that's okay. Like, we do need fat. I mean, there's fat-free Greek yogurt, but I like a little, like 1% or 2%, you know, but it really adds up to a really nice snack with a little fruit or a little something if you want to sweeten it. But like, I use it as a replacement for sour cream sometimes. So if like I'm chili instead of, you know, traditional sour cream, I'll add Greek yogurt to it or something like that. So it really, it's helped me a lot just as a quick, quick help.
Something quick. What, do you have a specific favorite brand of Greek yogurt?
It's funny. I've tested a lot. So I think Faye is the one that we have the most. It's good. Yeah. The one tricky part is I've looked for like organic Greek yogurts, and they're a little bit harder to find. And obviously priced a little bit higher. So
Got it. All right. Next question. If you have opinion on this, it's a very serious question. What are your thoughts on peanut butter? I love peanut butter. It's kind of controversial in the health world.
Here's the funny part. I was disgusted by peanut butter when I was a kid.
We wouldn't be friends as kids, man.
I know. And so like other kids, I was a typical Serbian kid. So I would come to school and I had like salami and cheese on my sandwich that my mom
a little charcuterie
prepared.
Board
right.
at 7 years old.
That's right. And the kids were probably like looking at me like, what the hell is he eating? But I was looking at other kids like, what is this brown thing that is kind of salty and sweet at the same time? So then in college, that's where I met my wife, and she's a dietitian. So she, you know, has views on things, and she introduced me to peanut butter. And since then, like, it's funny, I just had peanut butter for lunch, peanut butter and banana
you've come around.
It's so good. It's such I've come full circle.
We've Americanized you.
Being here 30 plus years tends to do that. But there are little things like that. Like peanut butter is one of them. Ketchup I didn't eat until I was in college.
I'm from Pittsburgh. So Pittsburgh, Heinz is like, it's like a national, it's like the state food, the state condiment. Yeah.
They put it in your kids meals.
Yeah,
and
they'll
everywhere.
Kick you out of the state if you don't like it.
Yeah. So I started, you know, but peanut butter I'm a big fan of now because there are different kinds of peanut butter too. Like you can get the crunchy, you can get the smooth.
So many choices.
So many choices in it. And I'm a big fan.
Okay, cool. And of course, organic, no sugar, all that stuff for everybody that's out there judging me right now.
You can, or not. Or, like, I mean,
yes. Live on the wild side, right? But I'm saying if it's DWC, Dr. Wakul approved, then I'm going to have some criteria for that. All right, next question. What's a book that you've read in the last year that's really inspired you? It could be fiction. It could be nonfiction.
I read this book by a writer named Chuck Klosterman called The 90s. And it's a book about the 90s.
Nice.
And I grew up in the 90s.
I didn't plan this.
It's like I like Chuck Klosterman because he's like a cultural writer, but he also views things from a slightly like askew perspective. And so it made me like rethink like the things that are become narratives versus reality. Like for instance, like Shania Twain and Garth Brooks. They were the biggest selling stars of the 90s. But when you think 90s, you think grunge and, you know, maybe more alternative music. So it's like the world as we remember it isn't necessarily what the world literally was like. Mm. And so just being able to open up my mind on a consistent basis
yeah.
is useful. So this book, I kind of went through it in like a day or like last week or so. So it was good.
I love that. Shout out to Shania Twain too. Some classics yeah. there. Some classics.
Garth Brooks, Shania Twain, they were huge.
Yeah. She recently, I saw, sang at Coachella, which she's still.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Kicking her.
Nostalgia comes back.
Oh yeah. The 90s comes, are still yeah. in vogue right now.
Yeah, they are.
Last question, super deep, not to leave it on a super deep note, but do you believe in life after death?
I do. I think I have no clue as to what it is. And I have not figured out, you know, what it is. Is it a God? Is it mm-hmm. some being? Is it heaven? Is it hell? But I think that there is some form of consciousness after death. Another book I recently read was about reincarnation and like looking at like real studies around.
Yeah, there's so much compelling data around that.
There are like, I was very skeptical of reincarnation, mm-hmm. but like there's, I mean, some of it you could explain with, you know, various things, but like in terms of children remembering past lives, all kinds of different reincarnation, kind of remnants in people that you just, it would be very difficult to explain away. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of pushed me a little bit further in that direction, but also just like energetically, I think there is something there. Mm-hmm. We are not just this body. We are more than this. And what that means afterwards, we'll see. I don't know yeah. whether it's a reincarnation or whether you get to live your life again, like over and over and over again. I think that's an interesting theory yeah. that I heard about recently. Who knows?
TBD.
But there is something just because like also the more I go into science, the more I realize how little science has explained mm-hmm. So far.
Yeah, it's so true. And I really appreciate the institutes, the colleges, the scientific literature looking at these things, looking yes. at us in that vein, because you're right, yeah. there's something there. And people can have faith and people can have a spiritual practice. That's one thing. But as Absolutely. Coming from a science side too, and I kind of hold both, and that's part of the reason of this podcast, it's the science and yeah. the art. And I think yeah. both are beautiful. And sometimes science can't explain everything, and that's okay. It doesn't make it delegitimate, you know?
I mean, not to get into too science, like look at quantum physics and all of
that's
that
what I was
stuff.
Thinking like, about yeah. when you said live your life over, like there's, when you just look at quantum physics, the little that I know about it, it is,
yes.
there's, it's mind blowing.
Multiverse stuff.
Yeah.
All kinds, like it just, to think about like, you think, you know, when I was a kid growing up, going through school, you think everything's kind of settled, right? You think, okay, do we know where we live?
Yeah.
We know, even with the human body, you know, when I was a kid, I had to have a bone marrow transplant as part of my treatment. And the bone marrow lives in your bones, right? But when they do a bone marrow transplant, they put it in your vein. They don't put it in your bones, they put it in your vein. So it goes through your bloodstream and it populates your bones. And I asked the doctors when I was a little kid, I was like kind of naive, like 7, 8 years old. I was like, so how does it do that? How does it go? How does it know to go from your vein into the bone? And they're like, we don't know. Like, we don't, like there are theories,
yeah.
but they didn't really, really have the exact yeah. reason for it. They did it through trial and error. They tested it over 50-100 years and know that it works. And there's so many things like that
yeah.
that we know kind of work,
yeah.
but we don't really know why they
yeah,
work.
The ultimate mechanism is not known. Yeah.
Right.
So true. So true. Vlad, this has been a rich conversation. I appreciate you immensely. Where can people learn more about your work and
sure.
get in touch with you?
So number one is our website, just betterandbetter.com. That's where obviously we sell our products and all that, but also we're really starting to publish a lot of the studies that we're going through. We have a whole section about learning. So we have texts and studies. And, you know, we work with a bunch of different chemists, biochemists, scientists. So we are constantly trying to push the story forward and the product forward. So our, you know, our vision for better and better is constant incremental improvement. So our toothpaste today isn't going to be the same as what we do tomorrow or the day after or so on and so forth. So, you know, better and better. And then from all of that is social media and beyond. But I think that's a good start.
Love it. Well, thank you again for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again for listening to The Art of Being Well. If you have a chance, please rate and review the podcast here. And if you like what you're hearing, hit follow and pass it along to a friend. To see more, head to drwillcole.com/podcast. I'll be back every Monday and Thursday, and I hope you will too. Talk soon.